gonna trap through a wall to give your taste buds a treat.
Try my barbecue bacon cheeseburger combo with sweet or spicy barbecue sauce topped with bacon and onion rings, plus fries and a drink for just $4.99.
Jack, I love you.
Okay. Only a Jack in the Box. Small fries and small drinks. Limited time only. Price and participation may vary.
Edition of the Batman Report. We go live every Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time and check in on the world of golf to bring you the latest news, insights, analysis, interviews, recaps, previews. Hey, we cover anything and everything golf. My name is Carlos Torres, and every week I'm alongside my co-host Fred Alvader. Fred, hi, how are you this week?
Carlos, it was a glorious weekend here in Northwest Ohio. The days are long. The sun is shining. It's one of the best times of all year to get out and play golf. Our local golf course here had a huge outing on Sunday. There were golfers everywhere, which reminds me, golf generates over $3 billion every year for charity. Do your part. Sign up for an outing in your area today. You get a chance to play a course you may not be familiar with or only get to play occasionally. Plus, you'll be helping a cause that needs financial assistance. So get out there and lose a few golf balls. Hey, Carlos, tonight in this edition of Back Nine Report, Jason Duffner came back strong to get his seventh PGA Tour win at Jack's Place. I.K. Kim, now fully healed from her trip down a stairway, won in New Jersey. Plus, the first USGA championships of the year were decided last week. We got a lot of golf to talk about, Carlos, so let's go.
Let's go, and as usual, we're going to have a VIP, very important guest on the week. He's a return guest to your good friend of the show, Mike May, so you don't want to miss that. He's going to talk to us about a dream trip, and that dream trip, you want to be part of it, so, or at least you're going to have it in your bucket list, so listen to that interview. But as usual, we start with the Par 5 news, we were the weekend back thing, where every week, Fred and I, check on what happened, the action in the major tournaments, and we recap it for you. And Fred, you're going to start talking about the tournament that happened, I think it was very far away from you, right? It's the Memorial Tournament.
Yeah, it's about two hours down the road down in Columbus, down to the Memorial, down to Muirfield Village. But it kind of gave us a preview for the U.S. Open coming up in just one more week. Jason Duffner blitzed the first two rounds at Muirfield Village with a pair of 65 and looked like he was going to run away with the tournament. But an ugly 77 on Saturday left him trailing Daniel Summerhays, who had posted three rounds with 66, 69, 68 to hold the 54-hole lead. The weather, as you know, every year down in Columbus, it seems like it rains and rains and rains some more, but it has been uncommonly beautiful for the first three rounds, and has happened in most years. There did pop up some thunderstorms on Sunday afternoon that interrupted play, but the storms, however, were a minor inconvenience, even though two stoppages of play were required, a winner was determined. The PGA Tour did a fantastic job anticipating the situation and managing the weather to keep everyone safe and get the round completed. Ricky Fowler, Justin Thomas, and Matt Kuchar all took turns figuring out how to lose Memorial on Sunday, but the ever-cool, calm, and collected Jason Duffner started knocking down pins with magnificent iron shots. Although he made three birdies on the front nine, he also made matching bogeys and headed to the backside at even for the round and falling behind the leaders. Birdies at number 10, 12, 15, as well as 17, plus a long par-saving putt at the last, gave him the final round 68 and the win at Jack's Place. Honor Ben Lahiri posted a 7-under par 65 on Sunday for the lowest round of the day and finished tied with Fowler for runner-up, three shots behind Duffner. I felt that Ricky Fowler was going to win. He was 4-under through 11 on Sunday, but bogeys at 14 and 18 left him behind the leader. Matt Kuchar and Justin Thomas had to settle for T4s. They both had their shots, just kind of fired and fell back on that back nine. It just got the best of them. You know, Muirfield Village is one of the most beautiful golf courses you'll ever play or see, but it is a brute, and it showed its teeth on Sunday. For example, of the 70 players in the field, and these are some of the best players in the world, only nine out of 70 hit the green, the par 3 number 16. Jack redesigned that hole a couple years ago, and it has become one of the most difficult on the course every year. The two par threes on the back, number 12 and number 16, are really kind of like short par fours for the average golfer. I want to mark down for the record, though, Carlos, I have parred both of those holes. But I have to tell you, I've made far more bogeys and double bogeys on those two holes than I ever will pars, I guarantee you. Other storylines for the week at the Memorial, Jordan Spieth was erratic once again. He posted a 966 on Thursday, and everyone thought this may be his week, but rounds of 72, 71, 73 left him T13. Not terrible, but you just not Spieth-like. He made double at number four, a par three, with no trouble except a bunker, and he doubled the eighth on Sunday, another par three with no water. Too many loose iron shots, and just not sharp. Jason Day finished T15, which is his best finish ever at Muirfield Village. Of course, he's a member of. He said in his poster on an interview, he feels he is close. There was a Bubba Watson sighting in Columbus as the two-time Master Champ got himself in position on Sunday, but a final round 73 left him at tied for sixth. Kevin Kisner had another good round and tied with Bubba for sixth place. You know, Carlos, I like Kisner as a favorite heading into Erin Hills for the U.S. Open. He's got a very simple swing. His short game is right on point. I kind of like Kevin Kisner heading up to Erin Hills, so you can kind of mark that down. We'll see how that turns out. The Captain's Club for the Memorial Tournament also announced that World Golf Hall of Fame member Hale Irwin, a winner of three U.S. Open championships, has been selected as the honoree for the 2018 Memorial Tournament. Irwin, who celebrated his 72nd birthday last week, two-time winner of the Memorial Tournament in 1983 and again in 85, making him one of just six multiple winners in tournament history. Also being honored posthumously next year will be two-time major champion Jock Hutchinson and Willie Turnessa, widely considered one of the game's finest amateur golfers. And then, Carlos, just a little side note to the Memorial. One of the things to keep an eye on as we go forward is a little nugget that Jack Nicklaus threw out at his annual meeting with the press early in the week. You know, with all the talk about the PGA Championship moving to May, and we talked about this a little bit, where would the Memorial go, where would it fit, or wouldn't it? You know, Nicklaus actually insinuated that the PGA may indeed be hosted at Muirfield Village at least once every 4 years during an Olympic year. He just threw that out to Pete Bavakwa and the PGA of America just in case they were listening. So there you go, Carlos, something to look for.
Oh, that sounds great. And, I mean, we were talking about it last week, but what could happen to the Memorial Tournament? And there is a lot of things to consider, but that would be an excellent, excellent idea to hold the PGA Championship every 4 years there. So we'll see. I'm sure we haven't heard the last about that. Regarding that tournament, Jason Dauphin, I just have to mention, you know, he had been struggling with his approach to the game, so this victory marks quite a turnaround for him. I mean, he's moving now to the 13th spot in the FedEx Cup standings, and he became the first player since Nick Faldo at the 1989 Masters to bounce back from a third round of 77 and win. I remember texting you, what course is he playing after the first round?
Yeah.
Because he was like, what is going on? He was 265, and it was like, oh, man. Then he shoots to 77 on Saturday, and nobody in the Memorial history had ever shot a 77 in a single round and win the tournament. He's the first one ever to do that. So great comeback by Jason Dauphin. He definitely was on point that weekend. So congratulations for him on his fifth PGA Tour win. Hey, let's talk a little bit about the LPGA. You know, the wind swirled around the big course at Stockton Sea View Hotel and Golf Club in the afternoon on Sunday, making club selection difficult. Players repeatedly backed off shots as they questioned whether they had the right club in their hands. But in the end, I.K. Kim, she dominated the element and held off two-time defending champion Anand Arkis on Sunday in the ShopRite LPGA Classic. Tied with Paula Creamer for a second-round lead, Kim shot a final round of 69 on the par 71 to win the $1.5 million Shoprite LPGA Classic by two shots over Anna Nordqvist. Fellow golfer Jenny Shin shoots out Kim with two beers after Kim sent her final putt on the 18th green and enjoyed a victory. But you mentioned it before about AK Kim, she's finally healthy, but you remember DJ at the Masters. Well, Kim wasn't one of the favorites coming into the week because during the off season she fell on the stairs and bruised her tailbone. The Classic was just her sixth event this year. Her best finish before the Shoprite was a tie for 16th at the Lottie Championship last month. The injury ended up having a positive impact since she had to let her legs and back recover. The 5'3" Kim spent the offseason working on her upper body, and he has to definitely show. Kim shot all three rounds in the 60s and finished with a 54-hole total of 11 under 202. She earned $225,000 for her fifth career LPGA win. The 28-year-old South Korean player won the Wynwood LPGA Classic late last season in China. Anna Nordqvist, two-time defending champion, she also shot a final round of 69. She definitely loved this course and this tournament, giving her four straight top five finishes at the Classic. Michelle Wee, as she rebounded from last week's missed cut in fine form, closing out in a tie for third after matching her season best round, as well as the low round of the day with a flawless 6-under 65. Wee in a four-way tie for third, four shots back at 7-under with Jenny Shin, Jackie Concolino, and Young On Lee. Her third top 10 result of the year has her eyeing a spot on the U.S. Solheim Cup team, which would be her fifth consecutive time making that squad. Wee was tied with Mo Martin at 11th in points before the event, is now in solo 10th place, and she would automatically make the team if, after the Women's British Open, she has a top 8 spot or if one of the top two U.S. players in the Rolex rankings. But, you know, American skipper Jill Inster could also make her a captain's pick. I don't know what you thought, June, but I think it's safe to say that, barring injury, Michelle will be on that team. Much of the crowd favors another star player trying to make that squad, but that player has to really mount Everest to climb to make it, and that is Paula Creamer, one of the LPGA's most popular players. She saw her first victory in 3 years. Fans were shouting as she walked down the first way, "Let's go, Paula! Take this tournament, Paula!" But her final round fell apart with back-to-back bogeys at 11 and 12 holes. She shot a 3-over par 74 and finished 5 shots back of Kim in the tie for 7th at 6-under with Mo Martin, Moria Itanagan, Yang Matty Green, and Gabby Lopez to round out the top 10. Other notable finishers, Song Yeon Park, the T12, Inbe Park, T17, Stacey Lewis, T32, Christy Kerr, T60, and the surprise of the season, definitely, Song Yeon Ryu. She missed the cut. And speaking of her, she had the chance to take on the world number one ranking by at least having a solo third finish, but by missing the cut on Saturday, then Arya Jutanagan was going to take the number one spot in the world ranking to be released yesterday as calculated by the ever-reliable computing software of the Rolex Rankings Projection Tool. So thank God we double-checked the Rolex Rankings on Monday morning, because after looking at the updated rankings, Cole was still in the top by 0.01 points over Arya. So wait, what? What was that? Well, long story short, there was a bug in the projection tool. According to an email explanation offered yesterday morning by the technical provider of the rankings, officials ran their projections at the beginning of the last week before the ShopRite LPGA event. Using the usual method of averaging points accrued during the past 104 weeks. But what happened? The projection tool mistakenly included the 2015 Manulife LPGA Classic as part of the calculation. Both Cole and Buchanan played in that event, giving them events play totals of 51 and 58 respectively. So when you average using that data set, Buchanan was projected to overtake Cole in the world rankings after the ShopRite. However, when the tour was run again Monday morning after the shop ride, the 2015 Manulife LPGA Classic was correctly bumped out of that 104-week window. So neither Cole nor Yatanagar played in the shop ride, so their number of events played using the calculating world rankings changed again from 51 and 58 back to 50 and 57. So if you change the number of tournaments played, you're going to change the average points. For Cole, it changed just enough. Their points are 8.37, and Yatanagar stands at 8.36. The Classic final round drew an enthusiastic crowd there. Fans filled the 18th hole grandstand as the leaders approached the final hole. And, of course, they were not thinking about that. But, Fred, at any rate, Cole is going to begin her 85th week on the top rankings. And we're guessing that the team with the Rolex rankings are going to double-check these projections this week before any promises are made about Cole losing her number one status.
Yeah, I know. I was looking at that, and they were projecting Aria to overtake Lydia, and then I saw where they had changed it. Said, hold the horses. We got to change that. Hey, Carlos, another thing, you know, ShopRite extended their sponsorship through 2023 of this event, so that's a good thing. And also a little inside the ropes information here. I was talking to someone, one of the caddies for one of the players this week out at the ShopRite. He's from here in town. And I was talking to him today for a minute. He said that Paula Kramer and her caddy were not getting along at all over that back nine when she was having trouble. And matter of fact, she fired him after the round. So Paula's going to be looking for a new caddy for next time she plays. So just a little insight there. Hey, the Web.com Tour had the Rex Hospital open last week, and just as it began to rain buckets at the TPC of Wakefield Plantation, Conrad Schindler dropped a two-putt par on the first playoff hole to win the Rex Hospital Open. Schindler had forced a playoff with Chesson Hadley by firing a final round 467. Schindler pockets $170,000 of the $650,000 purse. He is a Web.com Tour rookie who began the final round one shot back of the lead, but erased the deficit with a front nine of 4-under par 32. The win should guarantee him a top 25 for the Web.com Tour season and a pass in the big tour next year. Schindler has missed five cuts this year, but he's also notched two top five finishes now. Chesson Hadley is a hometown guy and won the 2013 Rex Hospital Open. A three-putt on the playoff hole could not have come at a worse time, however. This loss leaves a bad taste in his mouth. He feels like he let one slip away. A really bad putt at a really bad time, he said. He played well to make his run with a 5-under par 66 in the final round. Hadley was the 2014 PGA Tour Rookie of the Year. I think he won in Puerto Rico, that year, Carlos, if you remember that. Who was looking for a third career Web.com Tour victory and first since the 2013 Web.com Tour Championship. Andrew Putnam, 66. Andrew Landry had a 66. And Kyung-Hoo Lee, 69, all finished a shot out of the playoff at 14 under par for third. Stuart Appleby finished T39. Jason Gorin, Robert Allenby were T52. They were also on the field. And you know what, Carlos? I found something interesting. I was looking down through the leaderboard. I found a very familiar name. Two-time PGA Tour winner, 48-year-old Dudley Hart, was in the field for the Rex Open. He finished T33 with three rounds in the 60s. Hart has had just about everything that could go wrong for a golf professional happen to him. He fought a herniated disc in 2003. His wife suffered through a bout with cancer, and Hart had spinal fusion surgery in 2009, which kept him out of golf for 2 years completely. Another back surgery ensued in 2013. You know, Dudley Hart was one of the most consistent golfers on tour in his prime. And you know what? It's really great to see him getting back out there, mixing up these young guys. I imagine he's trying to get ready for the senior tour. But, you know, when I saw that name, I could not believe I saw his name on the leaderboard. So good to see Dudley Hart out there.
Most definitely. Hey, there was also, I'm sorry about that, awesome action in the European Tour where Renato Paratore, he showed his medal to hold on and claim his first European Tour title in the Nordea Masters The Italian finished one shot clear of Englishman Chris Wood and Matt Fitzpatrick. Paratore, he started the final round at the Nordic Masters at Barsbach Golf and Country Club, a stroke behind Chris Wood, but he beat the Englishman by two shots on the day to win his maiden European Tour title. Paratore, he got back into contention with birdies at the 8th and 9th holes, setting up a tight battle down the stretch. He moved in front with birdies at the 12th and then at the 14th holes, but hey, Wood moved back into a share at the top with a birdie on the 16th, but Paratore, he held his nerve to finish three pars there down the stretch, but Wood couldn't do the same. From the home hole, his tee shot found trouble in the trees, and the resulting penalty drop cost him a playoff spot. The 20-year-old said that it was amazing to be in the winner's circle with Italians now like the Molinaris, Manassero, and Rocca. Defending champion Matt Fitzpatrick, he fired a fine final round of 68, to end the week tied with Wood in second place, but it was Renato Paratore's first European Tour win. The 20-year-old claimed his maiden win in his 83rd appearance on the circuit. He's 20 years old, but he has 83 appearances so far. He will climb into the top of 150 in the official World Golf rankings. For Matt Fitzpatrick, you know, he put up a volley in defense of his title with a solid closing round. George Coetzee of South Africa raced up the leaderboard on Sunday. In testing conditions, he recorded 7 under par 66, which was a course record, and he moved up to finish into a tie for 4. Other notable finishers, Thorbjørn Olsen, T4, Jamie Donaldson recorded his first top 10 in almost a year, finishing in solo 7th. I have forgotten about Jamie Donaldson so bad that he's been playing. He's over the 250 in the world right now. Andy Sullivan finishing a T8. Alex Noren, one of the two top 10 suites in the world playing here, was finishing T15 with, among others, Lee Westwood and Alexander Lee. And Fred, the other Swede in the top 10 in the world that played in their home country championship, Henrik Stenson, he finished T26, but neither he nor Noren were ever a factor during the tournament.
You know, it seems like every week, though, we're mentioning Matt Fitzpatrick's name. He is putting together a tremendously consistent season. He's been playing at a very high level, so... you know what, you see this guy, I mean, there's nothing to him. He is a stick. He is a little guy. When he's walking down the fairway with these other guys, they just tower over him. But he is a pretty good player. Hey, Carlos, just real quickly, the NCAA Men's Division I Championship was last week. You know, we talked about Arizona State winning the NCAA Division I Women's Championship. But this week we want to congratulate the University of Oklahoma on their win at Rich Harvest Farms to become the NCAA Division I champions for 2017. They had to beat the defending champions, Oregon Ducks, to get it done. You know, and we said it before, but watch these college kids play in the college championships. It's just some of the best golf you're going to watch all year. Kudos to Golf Channel for covering that. They really do a very good job of it. And, Carlos, the USGA, we mentioned at the top of the show, held their first championships of the year, the men's and women's four-ball championships. And, Carlos, you know the old saying, and a child shall lead them? Well, that's exactly what happened in the USGA's third annual men's four-ball championship. Actually, two kids, 17-year-old teenagers to be exact, Ben Wong and Frankie Kappen, who still have another year of high school left. They posted 5 birdies on the final 8 holes to produce 2-1 victory over Kyle Udelson and Clark Collier on Pinehurst Famous number 2. Wong is committed to play at Southern Methodist in 2018, and Kappen will play for Alabama. And the women's side of the USGA Four-Ball Championship held at the Dunes Club in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, Alice Chen and Taylor Totlin, former teammates at Furman University, won the third U.S. Women's Amateur Four-Ball Championship. Totlin is 22. She's from Clinton Falls, New Jersey, just finished her senior year at Furman, while Chen, who is 21, of Princeton, has 1 year left at Furman. Ken and Tomlin used a familiar theme all week. They went out fast, making birdies early in each round to grab the lead and then kept the pressure on their opponents. So, Carlos, a couple of really good events here, the NCAA championships and then the men's and women's USGA four balls. So just a quick recap on those.
And to wrap up the action and some of the other minor tours, 23-year-old Joel Durback. He shot 17 under, 267 to win the European Tour Challenge, Tour Swiss Challenge on Sunday at Golf St. Parchisi in Lucerne in Switzerland. He carded six birdies in his final round and won by two ahead of Scotland's Craig Lee. Durback is the first Swiss winner of that event. Nana Cortes Madsen won her second Symetra Tour event of the season by shooting 8 under 205 to capture the Tucilo Kia Classic of New York Sunday at Capitol Hills in Albany. Madsen's play in the front nine during the three rounds included 11 birdies and one bogey. The Dane has been superb in her rookie season, notching six top 15 finishes in as many starts. Lee McCoy, hey, he shot 20 under 268 to capture his first Mackenzie Tour title, the Freedom 55 Financial Open on Sunday at Point Reyes Golf and Country Club in Vancouver, British Columbia. The promising 23-year-old out of the University of Georgia won comfortably in his first start in the circuit, coming in 8 strokes ahead of Hunter Stewart and the very promising Jordan Newbridge, who you might remember finished T6 as the lowest amateur in the Open back in 2015. And to wrap up, Curtis Yonke, she shot 14 under 270 to win the PGA Tour Latin America's Quito Open on Sunday at the Quito Tennis Club in Ecuador's capital. The 25-year-old from Kansas State University made 6 consecutive birdies on his front nine during the final round and beat Argentina's José Toledo by 2 strokes. And with that, we'll close the Week in Vaccine. Brett, any comments before we move on to the fourth call?
No, let's get to the news. I'm ready to go.
Let's go. Let's go to the previews now on the fourth call, and we're going to give you some quick previews about the major tournaments that are coming this week. And, Fred, there's action in Memphis with the PGA Tour and the FedEx St. Jude Classic.
Yeah, FedEx Classic played at TPC Southwinds. Daniel Berger is the defending champion. It's a $6.4 million purse with $1.15 million going to the winner. The field consists of 6 of the top 30 in the FedEx Cup race. You got Ricky Fowler. You also got Billy Horschel, Jim Furyk, Vijay Singh. 32 players who are qualified for next week's U.S. Open are in the field. 8 of the top 30 in the official world golf rankings. Ricky Fowler, Adam Scott, Francesco Molinari, Charles Fosler, Brooks Koepka. Phil Mickelson is going to play next week. Or this week, sorry. Kevin Chappell and Rafa Cabrera Bello. You got 12 major winners in the field. You got 7 players with double-digit PGA Tour wins. And did I mention David Duval, who now spends more time in the TV booth than on the golf course, but nonetheless, here he is trying to get his ball in the hole this week in as little strokes as possible. So see if David Duval can make a cut before he has to go back and work in the booth.
Oh, and also worth mentioning is that former U.S. amateur champion Peter Uihlein has been playing mostly on the European Tour, and he's playing very good. He received a sponsor's exemption. He tied for 25th this past weekend, gave him enough FedEx Cup points to be at least eligible for the Web.com Tour Finals to try to get a PGA Tour card. So be aware, Peter Uihlein is going to be playing there, and he's playing very good. And Patty Harrington is playing for the third straight weekend since returning from neck injury. In the LPGA Tour, the Miami Life Classic, the site is the Whistle Bear Golf Club in Cambridge, Ontario. There's going to be coverage Thursday and Friday, 1:30 to 3:30 p.m. through Golf Channel, and Saturday and Sunday, 3 to 5 p.m. also on Golf Channel. The defending champion, Caroline Bazan. Ariel Tanaran is the only player from the top three playing and would appear certain, I don't know because you know how these things are with the projection tool, but it appears certain to finally rise to number one in the world. The LPGA projected she would get to number one last week until it was discovered a mistake. So, I don't know. But anyway, with IT team winning the... Yes.
Lydia's not playing again this week?
No, she's not playing. She's not playing again, and Soyeon Rhee is not playing either. Which really... I thought Lydia was going to play the Miami Life. I mean, she always plays here in Canada, but I don't
right.
know. that was surprising to me that she's not on the field this week. And with IK yeah. King winning the ShopRite LPGA Classic last week, now the LPGA Tour has done 13 straight tournaments to start the year without a multiple winner. At this point, a year ago, four players already had multiple victories. Cole, like you said, you know, she's sitting out for first straight week. She has not won since the Marathon Classic last year. That's a span of 19 starts on the LPGA Tour. She's 18th right now on the LPGA money list. So I know what's going on, but we'll find out. Michelle Weed, she tied for third last week for her third top 10 of the year. She's going to be there. And Paula Creamer tied for seventh last week. It was the first time in the top 25 all season, right? So let's see. It's looking like a great tournament there shaping up in Ontario. But apparently, Adi Etanamer is poised to be number one finally in the world this week.
I know Lydia played a lot of the international events early in the year, but it's kind of surprising she's taken so many off here lately. I know there's a lot of golf coming up with the U.S. Women's Open and some more majors, but it's kind of surprising she's taken this much time off. There's more tournaments, so they can pick and choose a little bit more this year, and there's more. They're playing for more money, so I guess that's the benefit of that. Hey, Carlos, the old guys are in Des Moines, Iowa for the Principal Charity Classic this week. The 17th Principal Charity Classic will be played at Wakanda Club for the fifth year. Bernard Langer headlines the field trying to win his third consecutive event after adding two majors to his resume. The 78-player field also includes last year's champion, Scott McCarron, who posted top five finishes in the season's first two majors and is currently number two in the Charles Schwab Cup standings, albeit he is a long ways behind Langer. Other notable players in the field include three-time champion Jay Haas, Tom Lehman, David Toms, and Jerry Kelly. Should be a very competitive event. Well, 32 of the top 40 players in the current Charles Schwab Cup standings in the field. The only question, Carlos, is will Bernhard Langer take pity and let somebody else have the ball? Was he going to take his ball and go home, or is he going to let somebody else play?
Yeah, I don't think he'll do that. He'll just go for that. He has earned more money this year than the next two players combined. That's in the Scott
exactly.
So who's ever going to catch him? I don't know. But I really want to see also there are going to be three players that are averaging more than 300 yards in driving distance. That's Tommy Armour III, Kenny Perry, and John Daly. And this is a short course, so who knows? Maybe they'll be in contention and maybe try to take it there to Bernhard, but I don't know. I don't think so. Bernhard is just playing too good. And the European Tour, the Lyonnais Open, is going to be played at the Diamond Country Club in Attenbrook in Austria. 1 million euros is the purse. There's going to be television coverage Thursday and Friday from 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. and then from 9 a.m. to noon on Golf Channel. Saturday and Sunday would be very early, of course, 5:30 to a.m. to 10 a.m. also on Golf Channel. The defending champion is Wu Ashun Bernd Wiesberger. He's the home country boy, and he's the only player from the top 50 in the world. Of course, there's a lot of players that are either playing in the States a week before going to Wisconsin for the U.S. Open, so he's definitely playing. You got to understand this as his home country championship. Behind him, he menaced golf's most interesting man of Spain. He's playing on the regular circuit, but mainly because the 53-year-old now makes his home in Austria. Matthias Schwab, the top player for Vanderbilt, makes his pro debut in his home country. Schwab was the number one in the European amateur ranking and number four in the amateur and the world amateur ranking. So we have to take a look at Matthias' debut there. And Chris Wood at number 60 in the world is not playing this week, but he needs to stay in the top 60 to get into the U.S. Open. Among those who could pass him that are playing this week, but is playing in the PGA Tour at the FedEx St. Jude Classic, is Scott Piercy, who is number 61. So that's going to be the bubble battle to watch this week in between Scott Piercy trying to knock off Chris Wood from the U.S. Open first.
You know, Carlos, I'm kind of sitting right here in the middle of stuff. Last week, the Volvic Championship was up the road here at Ann Arbor. Then this past week, the Memorial was down in Columbus. This week, the Sumatra Tour is just a couple hours west of here, down the Turnpike in South Bend, Indiana, the home of the Golden Domers for the Four Winds Invitational. The sixth annual Four Winds Invitational is the ninth of 22 tournaments on the 2017 Sumatra Tour schedule. The 54-hole event begins on Friday and concludes on Sunday. The field consists of 144 players from the United States and 28 countries around the globe competing for a piece of the $150,000 total purse, with 22.5 going to the winner. Nana Kortz Madsen, who won the last event in New York, currently leads the Sumatra Tour money list with $53,000. She has two wins and four top tens in just six starts this year, and is looking for an instant promotion to the LPGA Tour with just one more win. Kortz is a rising star. She was 13th at the Olympics, representing Denmark, and she won on the Ladies European Tour just last year. Carlos, I also have a mention here for the Web.com Tour's Rust-Oleum Championship. They're out just outside of Chicago, a little bit farther west. Max Homa won there last year. They're playing for $600,000 and total purse of $108,000 going to the winner. And that's all I have, Carl.
And with that, we'll wrap up. Just four calls are pretty, so this is in action. So now, let's move to our Par 5 views every week. We pick five very good news, pieces of news, and bring them to you. And Fred, as usual, has the key shot on this one. And Fred, continuing from last week, you're going to report on Tiger Woods and now the fallout after all this, one week after. What's going on with Tiger?
Yeah, before I jump into that, Carlos, I just want to mention that NW Golf Links, the June issue, will be coming out this weekend, and we have a big U.S. Open spread in there talking about Erin Hills and all the stuff that goes on with the U.S. Open a little bit. A lot of other great information in NWO Golf Links. If you don't get that, go to nwo.back9mediagroup.com and you can find it there. And just click on any of the covers and read it. If you want to sign in, we'll get your email. We'll send it to you every month, no cost. Also, Back9 Report TV is available on Roku. And so if you want to get a little different take on golf news and information, go to Roku and download Back 9 Report TV. Check that out. So, Carlos, into the Par 5 news. We're talking about more fallout from the Tiger Woods DUI situation, and there's a lot of questions there. A lot of stuff I don't really agree with, but, you know, last week we talked about the unfortunate happenings of Tiger Woods. Well, this week the videotape of his arrest while sitting in his parked car, sound asleep and incoherent due to an overdose of prescription painkillers, made worldwide headlines. My question is it too much? Do we really need to see 90 minutes of police officers trying to test Woods, who is clearly out of his mind and basically unconscious? Would you want that videotape of you on Facebook, Twitter, and every other media outlet in the land for everyone to see and react to? Personally, I thought it was just a little bit too much. I really did not watch it. As we reported last week, a potent mixture of painkillers was to blame, and I hope this isn't the opening to Pandora's box of abusive drug behavior for Woods. Martin Keimer did make a video supporting Woods and basically told people to appreciate the Tiger Woods, who everyone enjoyed watching, hit monstrous drives, phenomenal iron shots, and pull long putts with his signature fist pump. He also asked for fans to pull for Woods to get through this personal problem and hope he can get back to some semblance of the great player he was in the past. The Chicago Sun-Times weighed in with an article wondering if Woods' golf course design project was in trouble in Chicago. The project merges Jackson Park and South Shore golf courses into one championship-caliber course and is estimated to cost upwards of $30 million. Brian Hogan, co-founder and director of the Chicago Park Golf Alliance, was asked what impact Woods' arrest would have on fundraising for the project, already stalled by the delay in completing design and engineering studies. He said, "We support Tiger Woods in a trying situation. We do not anticipate any imminent impacts. The Alliance remains excited about his involvement. Our confidence in raising $30 million to support golf course improvements and programming on the south side remain unwavering. So Tiger got a vote of confidence from the promoter of the Chicago project, but you know behind the scenes, these people could not be very happy with Tiger Woods. Have the wheels completely run off the track for Tiger, Carlos?
I don't think so. I mean, you all heard me last week. I don't know, someday, because we're not talking about a DUI because of alcohol or anything, or even any other type of really drug background. I mean, this is prescription for me. I want to give it like a once and done. I don't think that there's a problem for him of really being added to him. Otherwise, we would have heard from this before. I really don't think so. I don't think so. But he's like Donald Trump. I mean, anything that he does will be magnified, and people won't have enough of it. And really, this time, it's more than it should have been made up. I really hope this goes away. I don't know if you saw Martin Keimer's 2 minutes right there that he did. It was very heartfelt. And if you haven't watched it, you know, watch it. He says that my wish would be to stop being so nasty. Try to help. If he really has a problem, like Jack Nicklaus always said, I also said, let's help him. Why starting to put him down now and not try to help? If he really has a problem, we should all be trying to help him instead of putting him down. Like you very, very well said at the beginning, would you like to put yourself in his position? Would you like to be shamed that same way? How would you feel about that? Put yourself in the mirror and look for yourself first and see if you really are free of any shame. Then do it. But if not, you know, shut up and put up with it. Anyway, Arnold Palmer, golf's greatest legend. He died, as you might remember, September 25 last year at the age of 87. And that month, Forbes estimated Palmer had accumulated nearly $1.3 billion in earnings during his lifetime, coming from playing golf, but mostly it was from business ventures, merchandising, and endorsement of products ranging from tractors to supplements. Palmer won his last PGA Tour event in 1973, but he said he still made $42 million in 2015, according to Forbes. At the time of his death, only Michael Jordan and David Beckham made more as retired athletes. What is to become of that massive fortune that he left behind? While his will has become public and giving an insight into Palmer's charitable donations and income, the will and other supporting documents were filed in Orange County, Florida, Circuit Court, and local television station WESH has reviewed the documents showing parts will be distributed among his charitable foundation, late wife, former employers, and creditors. Palmer's widow, Kathleen, she was left $10 million. The bulk of Palmer's vast estate, which is worth approximately $875 million, according to Forbes, which includes multiple homes and golf courses, will be divided equally among his two daughters, Peggy Palmer and Amy Palmer. Arnie's Army Charitable Foundation, which began in 2015, has filed a claim seeking $10 million, nearly $10 million, over $9.991, an amount expected to be paid by the estate to continue its charitable work, and that's reported by WESH. There was no word available if any future donations to the charity were planned from the estate. Among the various charitable endeavors began by Palmer, like the Arnold Palmer Hospital for Children and the Winnie Palmer Hospital for Women and Babies, named for his late first wife, both are in Orlando. You might remember Palmer told WESH back in 2012, those kids, you know, one of the great things in my life is having a parent or a child come up and say, thank you for the hospital and what has happened at it. End of quote. Another $5 million has been set aside to satisfy creditors, and $25,000 was allotted each to 8 employees. The will remain under review until July, but Fred's altruism was a common refrain in the tributes to Arnie following his passing last fall. That is definitely a sentiment that we have seen in the division of the Kings of Faith.
Yeah, you know, once you're gone, it's just down to, you know, splitting up the pennies and the nickels. So I hope he had it all sorted out and everybody's going to, you know, get what they should have coming to them, I guess. Hey, Bill Hans has been consulting with Colonial Golf Club to update and modernize that golf course. With the Dean and DeLuca of the old Ben Hogan tournament moving to Coeur and Crenshaw's Trinity Forest next year, the Colonial Country Club will not host that tournament for the first time since 1941. The course has just become too short and out of date. Famous Texan and Hall of Fame golf writer Dan Jenkins said, it lacks its original challenge and often allows today's touring pros to shoot scores here that would make a Ben Hogan vomit. Hogan, the late golf legend from Fort Worth, won 5 Colonial titles during his 71-year history as a PGA Tour stop. Hogan posted the course record in the final round of the 1946 Havana 65, and that stood for 24 years. You know, Carlos, we have a similar situation here in Toledo. Famed Inverness Club wants desperately to host another U.S. Open and has hired a team of designers to expand the course and make it more adaptable for the current players. From watching the play at the Colonial last week, many players were hitting irons off the tees, and the driver was basically just taken out of their hands. The tight dog legs and short par fours are not what today's game is all about. I'm afraid it's going to take more than Gil Hans and a few renovations to make Colonial relevant in today's golf atmosphere, Carlos.
Hey, and so the game said farewell to one of the greats, as Roberto Di Vincenzo passed away at the age of 94 last week. Like many, my knowledge of the man didn't extend too far beyond his extraordinary scorecard gap at the 1968 Masters and his now immortal words following the blunder, "What a stupid I am." But I spent a fair bit of time learning more about the man this past few days that comes to the resounding conclusion that remembering him simply by his signing away a green jacket does a profound disservice to one of the finest individuals to have graced our game. Honestly, can you think of another situation in life where signing something with a pencil can be so binding? I mean, the Masters Sunday in 1968, for those who don't remember or don't know this, was the Argentinian's 45th birthday. He made an explosive start, rolling out with a 9-iron for an eagle 2 at the first hole. But his popularity already at meteoric highs, an elated crowd began to sing happy birthday in unison. Rocco's delirium ensued as De Vincenzo stormed to a 31 on the front nine. He kept up the momentum on the back nine, too, with birdies at 12 and 15, and seemed to have the Masters under his thumb after a Jack Nicklaus 86-esque birdie at 17. But it all went wrong. He pulled his 4-iron approach to the final hole, and despite a decent recovered chip, missed a 6-foot par save. The crowd continued to sing happy birthday to him, but he wandered off afterwards, somewhat aggrieved, realizing a Monday playoff with co-leader Bob Goldie was now inevitable. Or was it? Tommy Aaron had somehow not noticed his playing partner's 3 at 17, thriving a 4 instead. And absent-minded, De Vincenzo signed on the dotted line for what he thought would be one of the great final round 65 of all time at Augusta. Yet, owing to Aaron's glitch, rules official Hort Haddin had no choice but to chuck it up as a 66, meaning the birthday boy missed out by 1. As stupid he was indeed, but it wasn't the only legendary quote to emerge from that incredible agonizing day. Let's recap a couple more. All my life, if I make a mistake on the golf course, the next day I forget, I have a chance to recover. This mistake no chance to recover. Another gem. After the Masters, I should be shot. But people, the fans, they seem to love me. I lose, I do a stupid thing, and I'm a hero. Then, my other personal favorite. When Bob Goldie and I meet in heaven, we are going to end this duel left unfinished on earth. End of quote. But perhaps the one which is the greatest measure of the man was during his latter years. He said, I've gotten more out of signing the card long than I did even if I had signed it correctly. Every now and then I will drop a tear, but I've moved on. I got to see the world through golf. No one should feel sorry for me. End of quote. And why would you? One look at his career shows just how much he achieved. More than enough to dwarf the disappointment of Augusta 68. He picked up the first of his 231 professional victories at the 1942 Little Open in his homeland, and the last in the 1980 at the inaugural U.S. Senior Open. In total, he won 48 national championships, the pick of which was the 1967 Open at Hoylake, where he held a charge, he held off the Churchill Nicholas by 2 strokes, making him the oldest champion at 44 since Old Tom Barty. He tasted triumphs in 17 different countries and was also a member of the winning Argentinian team at the first ever World Cup of Golf in 1963. It didn't come easy. He was one of some children to a Buenos Aires house painter, but he quickly learned the meaning of hard work. Hitting 400 balls a day was a standard procedure, each of which incorporated the same meticulous pre-shot routine. He traveled more than 15 million miles in his career to various golf tournaments around the world, too, and he visibly, appreciably enjoyed every second of it, even in his twilight years. But every obituary you read paints quite a picture of the Vicenzo, whose appeal was so enduring. Unfailingly genial, goodness all the way through, never in a bad mood, a true gentleman until the end. It's all there and more, and it goes far beyond the usual platitudes, lip service, and respect people offer up. What we had was a quite exceptional man and a true champion of the game. Fred, even for those like me who never saw him play, his legend will not quickly be forgotten. May you rest in peace, sir. And enjoy your rematch with Goldie as you did everything else in life.
Yeah, I remember watching DiVincenzo play several times on several occasions. He was a very, very good golfer. You know, you're right. You know, you paint the picture that he was very beloved. He was kind of the Byron Nelson of international golf. Everybody, he just had that personality. Everybody really loved him. He had 230 professional golf wins, Carlos, around the world. That's an amazing statistic. That is the most wins, I'm pretty sure, by any individual player by far. I don't think Gary Player can even catch that number. Greg and Norman, you know, if you remember, we talked with Greg Norman last month. He referred to a new business venture, but was not willing to share any details with us at that time. Forbes now is reporting that Greg is investing $11 million and has teamed with Verizon to create the first smart golf course. Greg said, PlaySight is on the forefront of technology, innovations in sport, and I am thrilled to be part of something so cutting edge in the industry. Norman and Verizon Ventures, the corporate venture capital unit of Verizon, are investing in PlaySight, a U.S. company that has invented a so-called tennis smart court based on Israeli Air Force technology that offers athletes and coaches instant video analysis. Their partnership will aid in global expansion and introduce revolutionary technology in golf and new sports verticals, PlaySight said in an email statement. Since retiring in 2012, Norman has become one of the most successful athletes turned businessmen in the world. The technology will help athletes and golfers of all levels to train better and smarter. Sophisticated video analytics and media solutions once reserved for professional athletes and teams are now becoming accessible to the masses. by leveraging a network of intelligent cameras, play sites, cloud-based video, and analytics platform, transforms every sports field, court, and gym into a smart, connected space and helps athletes of all levels train smarter. Other prominent athletes, including tennis stars Billie Jean King, Pete Sampras, and former world number one Novak Djokovic, have also made commitments to invest in new technology and partnership. Technology is the key word here, Carlos. I mean, you're involved in technology every day. You know, the innovators just keep coming up with new and unique ways to use knowledge to improve our lives. Just one more thing along this. When I was up at Boeing, a few weeks ago, going through the training program up there, everything they did was on tape. And so then he also has a constant contact kind of thing where he's constantly sending me stuff. He would send me some of the videos, say, hey, take a look at this with a comment. So, you know, and I can take video and shoot it back to him and he can look at it. So, you know, this use of technology and cameras and video, and you don't have to be in the same place to get a lesson or to have somebody, your coach, look at your swing. All this stuff just keeps going to a higher and higher level, Carlos.
I totally have to agree with you on that. I mean, technology, and we have seen it from Top Golf, who's using an innovative way to attract more people. And we've seen it, the millennials, and we've talked about this before, they're attracted by all this technology gadgets, and we have to make it available to them. Otherwise, we will never attract them as new golfers there. But, hey, with that, we'll wrap up our Par 5 news. Now, we're going to talk about the practice range. So every week, Fred and I pick a topic, and each of us take our own shot at it. This week, what's going to be more important than next week, we're going to have the preview, and we're going to have Keon Clark with us to preview the U.S. Open. But we have to say that, you know, there are the qualifiers. There's a range of emotions that you can expect from when some 750 players were spread across 10 cities to compete for only 53 spots in the U.S. Open. But that wasn't limited to the final stage of the U.S. Open qualifying or even the golf course. I mean, there were among nearly 2,000 PGA Tour players who withdrew from the U.S. Open qualifying before it even began that Monday. Others didn't sign up, leaving them open to one of the oldest restraints in golf. You can't win if you don't enter. In some cases, however, there was a lot to lose, like your jobs. You know, the competition is stronger than ever on the PGA Tour. There was no doubt that that played a role in so many withdrawals in the days or weeks leading up to sectional qualifying. Roughly one-third of the players from 100th to 200th in the FedEx Cup standings were not at the U.S. Open qualifying. So, Fred, tell us a little bit about what happened in this qualifying, and then I'll follow up.
Yeah, you know, yesterday, was golf's longest day. And so local qualifiers were held in May, at the end of May, and over 9,000 hopefuls tried for spots. I think 902 golfers moved on from the locals, and they moved into sectional play, and there were 10 sectionals held around the country. So, and of those 10 sectionals, 72 spots in the field for Erin Hills next week were open for 902 golfers trying for those 72 spots. So I'm just going to kind of go around the country here a little bit, Carlos, and talk about each one. California, Stuart Hagestad, who we remember that name, he was the low amateur in the Masters this year. He just continued his most excellent year, making his second consecutive major tournament field. He fired a 4-under par 67 at Newport Beach, and then he put another 4-under par 68 at his home course, Big Canyon. So the mid-am champ, he moves on, and he's going to be at Erin Hills in the U.S. Open. Hogstead also joined Scott Harvey, who advanced from the New Jersey sectional, and he's a former U.S. mid-amateur champion, and he'll be in the field for the U.S. Open. This will be the first year that two mid-am champions qualified for the same U.S. Open since the championship was founded in 1981. Kevin Dockery of Murrieta, California, was a lone professional to survive the California sectional. Daugherty, 26, grew up with Ricky Fowler and received a motivational text from Ricky. Bo Hosser, Paul Goitis, and Max Homa all failed to qualify at that sectional. In all, six players earned spots in the field at Erin Hills. But as I mentioned, Daugherty was the only pro. So five amateurs and only one pro got in out of those four out of those 103 players in that sectional. In Georgia, Stephen Yeager, remember him? He's a guy that shot a 58 on the Web.com Tour. And amateur Alex Smalley punched tickets to Erin Hills out of 36 players in Georgia. A couple that didn't make it, Davis Love, the fourth. Davis Love is the son, who plays at, I believe, Alabama. Missed a berth by one shot and is a first alternate. In Maryland, Sam Ryder blew away the field with 11 under par at the Maryland sectional. Kyle Thompson and Ben Coles earned the other spots for the U.S. Open. Lexi Thompson's brother Nicholas fired a fine first round 69, but a second round of 75 knocked him out of one of the top spots. Billy Hurley, third, and Jason Gore also failed to qualify in this sectional. New Jersey, Daniel Chopper, remember him? Used to be a pretty good player. Topped the 80-man field to nab one of the five spots available at the New Jersey site. Professionals Matt Campbell and Andy Pope also made it out, plus two amateurs, Christopher Crawford and Scott Harvey. So if you're picking this up, Carlos, a lot of amateurs did well in these sectionals. There's going to be a lot of amateurs in the U.S. Open. Maybe the biggest story of the qualifying day happened in Memphis, Tennessee. Mr. Wisconsin, Steve Stricker, topped a very strong field to grab one of the nine available tickets. Andy Romero, Troy Merritt, Ches Reavy, Harris English, Garrett Osborne, Trey Mullen, Xander Schauffele, and Jonathan Randolph were the other qualifiers. So, you know, Strick says, okay, you're not going to give me a special exemption. I'll just bop on down to Memphis, and we'll qualify down there. And he just won medalist honors, and he's one of the nine out of the 108 that got through. So good for Strick. That'll be great to have him in the field. I hope he does well. I hope he does really well. Scott Brown, Paul Malnati, Retief Goosen, Ken Duke, Stuart Appleby, Robert Garrigus, J.J. Henry, and Spencer Levine did not get out of that sectional there. So that was a pretty strong sectional also that Stricker qualified at. In Dallas, Texas, Roman Robledo topped the field and will be joined at Erin Hills by Nick Flanagan and amateur Walker Lee, another amateur. Brian Palmer was three shots farther back and is the first alternate out of the Texas sectional. Woody Austin, Hunter Mahan, and Martin Pilar failed to qualify. In Tacoma, Washington, Derek Barron was medalist with John Niebrug, Max Grayerson, and Daniel Miernicki earning the spots. Do you remember Tad Fukuzawa from Hawaii, the little short guy? From a few years back, he's still trying to get it done, but he failed to qualify at Tacoma. He was there, though. This had to be the weakest sectional. I looked down through that field, and there was just, I mean, a lot of amateurs and just no names there that you ever heard of. So that's the one you should have gone to if you were looking to get in. Then we come to Ohio. There were two sectionals held in Ohio because of the Memorial Tournament. A lot of the pros are there, and so they want to play someplace close. Canadian Corey Connors was medalist at the Springfield, Ohio Country Club sectional. Then Brian Stewart, Bryce Garnett, and Ryan Brem earned the four exemptions out of the 77-man field there. Missing the cut was our friend Zach Blair, Tony Finau, and James Hahn. And then in the big one, this was the strongest field by far in Columbus. They played two courses, Brookside and the Lakes. Both are very, very good golf courses. A pro from St. Simons Island, Georgia, J.T. Poston, was the medalist with Jason Kokrak, Bud Cauley, Martin Laird, Keegan Bradley, Stuart Sink, Jamie Lovemark, Bryson DeChambeau, Chen Sung Tan, David Linworth, Ted Potter Jr., Peter Uline, Scotty Scheffler, an amateur, and Taylor Gooch, rounding out these exemptions. Uline, Scheffler, and Gooch had to win in a playoff with Michael Putnam, the loser, and he becomes the first all-rounder. So I'm guessing, though, Carlos, he probably has a pretty good shot of getting in the field at Erin Hills next week. Cause, you know, this is the strongest field, so he's probably like the number one alternate of anybody. So if somebody falls out, gets sick, whatever, I got a feeling that Michael Putnam's going to get in. Johnson Wagner was the second all-rounder, and he might get in too. Guys that didn't make the cut here, Luke Donald, Kevin Tway, VJ Singh, D. Davis Love, as well as Kelly Kraft and Patrick Cantlay, who were the finalists in the 2011 U.S. Amateur. Kraft, who defeated Cantlay 2-up in that 36-hole final, carded 2-0 for 74 at Brookside to finish 2-under, 142. Cantlay was in really good shape. I saw his score after he played the first round at the lake. He had a shot of 66, and then he slipped to a 75 at Brookside in the afternoon. So he didn't make it. I guess that's all I've got on it, Carlos. But, you know, the U.S. Open qualifying is one of the most unique events involving a lot of players. You know, they start out with over 9,000 entries, and they whittle it down to 902 that go into these sectionals. They spread them out into 10 different states, move these guys around and get them in there, and out of that, 72 guys have moved on into the field, plus they've identified the alternates, so if somebody gets sick, gets hurt, whatever, can't play, some family emergency, so they've got guys to fill in. So, Carlos, we pretty much got the field set for next week at Erin Hills.
Yeah, I think you pretty much covered everything that I was down here as a note to say. I mean, I can only speak maybe of some players that didn't even try, like Patrick Rogers, Jeff Ogilvie, Ricky Barnes, who really expressed themselves as not even going to try it because they wanted to concentrate more on the rest of the year, and they were not even close enough. But, yeah, some surprises there in Ohio, like you mentioned, also Luke Donald, CJ Singh, Ollie Niederjans, one of the promising youngsters. He missed it out in that second alternate spot to Jensen Wagner. I believe, and we're going to talk to a little bit more about Michael Putnam's chances, because there's somebody that's not going to be playing there next week, so there's a chance for him to get in. But Peter Uline, definitely, he's playing good. We haven't heard a lot from him because he's been playing in the European Tour, but that's one guy that you want to keep an eye on. Also, you mentioned what you call maybe the most or the least, the easiest way there to qualify. It was out of that.
Tacoma.
I'm sorry? In Tacoma Country?
Tacoma.
In Gulf Columbia, yeah. In Washington.
Yeah.
You know, Derek Barron was there, but Jordan Newbridge, the former Oklahoma State golfer, was an amateur. I mentioned it before because in the weekend action, he finished T6 at the 2015 Open Championship. He's now with Pro, and he's coming off of T2 at the McKenzie Tour season opener. He posted another T2 in Washington. So he put up a 4-under 67 in the afternoon. He's really one player to take a look and make sure that we watch him. He's another promising player. So definitely a lot of action, but I am very happy that Steve Stricker is going to be there. I mean, more than just earning one of those 9 spots in that top 10 if he qualifies. Drake, he closed with a wedge to tap in birdie range to cap off the 67-65 day and finish first. And on those 9 qualifiers, Drake is playing very good. I mean, we have seen his results. He has this resurgence in him, and he's going to play there at Erin Hills, which is a public course built on pristine pasture land there in Wisconsin that only opened in 2003. And he was asked by the original owner, Bob Lang, and the USGA executive, to come along for a visit to give a close perspective. He knew he would be 50 when the U.S. Open came to Erin Hills, but he never knew it would be such an ordeal to get there. But he made it, and he felt all right. I mean, that's the one guy I want to see playing there. Andy North has two U.S. Open titles, but nobody scores in majors has more PGA Tour victories than Strix, which is 12 titles. So I'm very happy that he made it there. But.
Yeah, I think Strix is probably the biggest story of the week. There was a kid who flew in somewhere. I forget where he flew in, and his clubs didn't make him. He even had a priority to get through. He had a ticket and everything.
Oh, yeah.
And his clubs didn't make it. He didn't try to get rentals or anything. He just said he just bagged it in WD. So then he got in a Twitter battle with the airline. That's the way to do it. You just don't call him up and yell at him. You got to get a Twitter and make a big deal about it. But you mentioned Ollie Schneiderhans. I watched Ollie hitting balls on the range Thursday down at the Memorial a little bit. We've been looking for him to play well. I think he will one of these days. He's one of these young guys that we want to kind of keep an eye on. He's a really good player. This is not a U.S. Open thing, but I was watching that Cameron Smith, the kid that played so well earlier in the year. And I'm telling you what, I mean, he looks like he should be in junior high school. This kid looks so young. But, I was watching those two young guys hit balls in the range over there. So, no, Carlos, that wraps up kind of what I had about the U.S. Open qualifying. Just as always, the field down here in Columbus, because of all the guys are in town for the Memorial, was really, really strong. And, it's always a long day. It's exciting. A missed putt here, a missed putt there, a chip shot that goes in. I mean, it just makes a world difference for these guys to get the chance to go play in the U.S. Open.
By the way, before we close, the name of the kid that missed, that was forced to withdraw from the U.S. Open section, was Michael Butacavoli. He plays on the PGA Tour Latin America, and he was flying American Airlines overnight from Ecuador. He was playing there at the Quito National, so he made it for his 7:26 a.m. tee time, but his club, however, did not. So very unfortunate for him to have to withdraw from the U.S. Open section, but hey, he learned from this. I would have fly in FedEx. Anyway, with that, we wrap up our practice range. Now it's time for a very important guest of the week. So it's Mike May. He's going to give us a preview of the Atlantic Link golf trip. So he's, as you might know, he's a golf travel writer and contributor to NWO Golf Links as well as several other golf publications. And he's about to embark on a dream golf trip to the southwest of England, and he's going to tell us why golfers may want to consider 6 courses in the Atlantic Links in Devon and Cornwall for their next golf trip to Europe. I'm already very jealous of this. And Fred, how about this interview that you have for us?
Yeah, along with this, we've got an article in the NWO Golf Links for June, and there's June issue coming out, like I say, later this week. That also talks about, he wrote it to talk about his trip. And he's been planning this for almost a year, this trip. He's put a lot of thought and effort into it. Mike spent a few years in the southwest of England while he was in high school. He went to high school there, actually. His father and his parents ran an inn there. And so he got to play golf. He learned to play golf on the links courses there and got to spend some time over there. And so this is kind of a little bit of a homecoming for him. And he's really looking forward to it. He's fired up. And go ahead and play the tape, Carlos. He talks about the Atlantic links and the southwest of England.
Hello, Fletcher.
We are happy to have Mike May with us again here at Back Nine Report. Mike has been on the show before. He is a contributing writer for NWO Golf Links, and Mike spends a lot of time traveling around the country, visiting golf courses and writing travel reviews for several different golf publications. And this summer, just a matter of fact, in a week here or so, he's going to take a big trip to England. Mike, welcome to the show.
It is a pleasure, and I've already started the packing process.
The weather gets a little bit different over there, so you've got to take a lot of different stuff. But when we think about going to Europe to play, everybody thinks about going to Scotland or Ireland. You're going to it's called Atlantic Lynx. What is that, and why are we doing this?
Well, I actually spent some of my high school, teenage, formative years in the southwest of England in the county of Cornwall in the small fishing village of St. Ives, and I learned to play golf over there on a Lynx golf course. So I sort of have a vested emotional interest in golf tourism and opportunities in the southwest of England. So many people, when they go to the United Kingdom, they just head north of Scotland, which does have some remarkable golf courses, Lynx golf courses. Well, there's some also remarkable Lynx golf courses in the southwest of England that I'll be visiting. Again, it's called the Atlantic Lynx. It's a group of courses that have been around since the 1800s that have marketed themselves as a trail, somewhat very similar to the Robert Trens Jones Golf Trail of Alabama. Well, we have six courses at five clubs in the southwest of England in Somerset, Devon, and Cornwall that I'll be visiting and playing and writing about and telling the world why, if you do go to the United Kingdom, there's other options than Scotland.
They have a website, which is atlantic-links.co.uk. If you just Google Atlantic Lynx, that will come up. On their website, they say England's Atlantic Lynx is a tantalizing trail of six premier championship Lynx courses in southwest England that has quickly established itself as one of the premier golfing destinations in the UK. Mike, you talked briefly about the courses and where you're going to stay, and it sounds delightful. The courses sound just as great as playing King's Barnes or St. Andrews or you know, someplace in southwest Ireland.
It is. I've got one course that I'm opening up with on Friday, June 16th at 12:58. So it's basically a 1 o'clock tee time at Burnham and Barrow in Somerset. Burnham and Barrow is located in the community of Burnham-on-Sea. It's just over a two-hour journey west of Heathrow Airport. I arrive that morning at 6:25. I'll clear customs, get my bags, get my rental car that's already reserved, and I'll head west to Burnham and Barrow, and I can just visualize being on that first tee at 12:58 on the afternoon of Friday, June 16th, which is the second day of the United States Open, which will be at Erin Hills in Wisconsin.
You said you spent time in high school. You grew up. You spent 4 or 5 years in England, and what is it that you most remember about being there, growing up, and playing golf there?
Well, I learned to play golf at the West Cornwall Golf Club. It's the oldest golf course in the county of Cornwall, which is one of the counties that I'll be visiting. And just the creativity, the imagination that's required to play Lynx golf really challenges you to think outside the box and think creatively. Every day is different. The conditions are always different because of the wind and the possibility of rain. There's no 2 days that are alike at the West Cornwall Golf Club, or for any Lynx course, for that matter.
Some of the courses you mentioned, you mentioned earlier, Burnham and Barrow, Trevose, St. Enadoc, Royal North Devon, Staunton East, and Staunton West. Some of these courses I've heard of before. Trevose especially is supposed to be one of the best Lynx golf courses in all of Europe. Royal North Devon, we've heard about before. Staunton East is highly recognized as a great Lynx golf course. So you're going to be playing some great golf courses while you're over there.
I could not have picked a better group of courses. Trevose and St. Enadoc are in the county of Cornwall. They're in North Cornwall. And then once you cross the border into Devon, you've got Royal North Devon, which is the oldest golf course in England. And inside the clubhouse is a group of memorabilia, almost like a museum, that they say is second only in stature to St. Andrew's display up in Scotland. And, of course, Staunton East and Staunton West, that's a 36-hole venue at the Staunton Golf Club. And Nick Faldo has been quoted as saying that if Staunton East and Staunton West were maybe near a bigger population center with more hotels and better infrastructure, it probably would have hosted an Open or two by now. So, and actually, Staunton East is a course that Sergio Garcia won the British Boys Junior Championship back in like 1996. So it's a course with great pedigree, as they all are, and they've all been around since the 1800s. And again, they've marketed themselves as a group, as a trail, so that you're not coming to play one of them, but really coming to play hopefully all six courses, but at least three or four of them.
Yeah, real briefly, too, it's just not about the golf on this trip. You talk about some of the great hotels that you're going to be staying in, a lot of history there. Also, sampling the cuisine and the food of the area is a treat also.
Yes, the first night, actually, I'll be quite exhausted by the end of the round. Of course, all these rounds, you either walk or use a pull cart. There's no golf carts unless there's a medical issue or need one. But by the end of the day, at Burnham and Barrow, I'll probably have some fish and chips for dinner, and they actually have an on-site facility that has like eight beds called the Dormy House, D-O-R-M-Y. And I'll be staying the first night at the Dormy House. At Trevose, they have, I think, a four-star facilities, and I'll be staying there one night. And then also I'll be staying at a, prior to my round at Saunton East and Saunton West, I'll be staying at the Saunton Sands Hotel, which overlooks a spectacular sandy beach along the North Devon coast near Braunton. The food will be spectacular. I'll probably eat a lot of seafood, including a meal at the Squire's Fish Restaurant near Braunton. It's considered the finest fish restaurant in the county of Devon. So I'll be working up an appetite and satisfying it every night with some marvelous cuisine, not just fish and chips.
Mike, on this trip, several sponsors have stepped up to support you and your efforts on this trip, and why don't you just give them a mention and some of the sponsors are helping you out with this.
Yes, I'd be happy to. Of course, I'm using golf clubs from Mizuno that came through the PGA Tour Superstore. The good friends at Carnoustie in Antigua are supplying me all the necessary clothing, including some rain gear. Hopefully I won't need it. Gold Toe Golf Socks have supplied me with a number of socks. In fact, so many that I will give a pair of complimentary socks to each club secretary and golf pro at each course. I've got some Titleist Pro V1 golf balls through a retailer named Matt Godek Rugby and Soccer Supply in Merrifield, Virginia. New Balance is sending me some golf shoes, and I've got some great golf clubs from Bionic Gloves, part of their new Performance Grip Pro Golf Club series. And I also got some support from Visit Britain, who is taking care of my airfare, which is awesome. And, of course, I all this has been possible because of the work of a PR gal in London who represents the Atlantic Lynx. Her name is Helen Hetty, and she has really helped set up my agenda and the itinerary, and it's second to none.
Well, Mike, sounds like this is a dream trip for you, kind of going back to the area where you spent some time in high school and as a homecoming of sorts, but also getting to see some great golf courses and then being able to write about it. And Mike, I want to mention that Mike has also written an article, and it will be in the June issue of NW Golf Links. It'll be coming out here very soon, and I'm sure, Mike, you have placed that article in other magazines around the country. I think you have something like eight outlets that you're providing articles for, so we hope you have a great time on this trip.
Well, I will, and one thing's for sure, I will send you and your wife a postcard from the United Kingdom.
Look forward to it. Mike, thanks again for being on Back Nine Report.
It's a pleasure.
There you have it. That was Mike May talking to us about his upcoming trade to Atlantic Lynx. So, Fred, anything you want to add before we move on to our final part?
No, I think I pretty much covered it. Like I say, he does a lot of traveling. He is around the country all the time, checking out different golf courses, does a lot of writing. And he has been really excited about getting this trip done, and we'll hear more about it once he gets back. We'll have him back on again.
Excellent. Hey, let's move on to the final thoughts now before we close the show. Victory would have made him just the sixth man in history, in the golf history, to win all four majors, but Phil Mickelson would not be traveling to Erin Hills, Wisconsin for this year's U.S. Open. Family takes precedence for the five-time major winner, who will instead attend the graduation ceremony of his daughter, Amanda. The Pacific Ridge School confirmed commencement is scheduled for the morning of June 15, clashing with the first round of the U.S. AGA flagship event. His daughter, class president and tri-sport varsity athlete, is among the designated speakers. Mickelson hasn't missed the U.S. Open since his first 4 years as a pro, in 1995, but stressed there's just really no way to make it, bearing a weather delay for the opening round or a late change to the ceremony time, but we already see that Pacific Ridge said no. So opposed for the review of the weather forecast. Yep, you guessed it. Nothing seems to do well for him. Literally, it's supposed to rain every single day except one day. Joe Mickelson needs it too. And that's Thursday, and it's not going to rain. Doesn't look good for him. Hey, and on my other pod here, Jeff Orton hasn't played on the PGA Tour, but once in 2017, missing the cut in February at the Honda Classic. On Sunday, Overton's wife, Christina, went on Twitter on his birthday to explain the harrowing, frightening circumstances surrounding his absence from the PGA Tour. Following the Honda, Overton had chosen to take off a few months to deal with a herniated disc, ultimately choosing to have a minimally invasive surgery to improve his discomfort. But unfortunately, in the procedure, he contracted a life-threatening spinal infection, which he has battled for months. Overton spent more than a month in a hospital rehab center recovering, dealing with excruciating pain, lots of medicine and IVs. Before missing the cut at PGA National, his last PGA Tour start at the RBC Canadian Open in July of 2016 ended in withdrawing. Hopefully, Fred, Overton can not only make a complete recovery, but in due time make a return to the PGA Tour. We wish him the best and a speedy recovery, Jeff.
Boom, baby. Boom, baby. Wasn't that him? That's the, yeah, the Ryder Cup with Bubba? Hey, the Washington Post and New York Times are still reaching for negative Trump stuff. We discussed last week the negative press around the senior PGA Championship. Still, yep. And the Washington Post and New York Times have taken a different tack this week and are using questionable data to suggest players are not flocking to Trump's new course in the New York area. You know, go figure. You got to get the Trump name in there for that SEO, Carlos. You pointed that out last week. Hey, Sand Valley has opened to rave reviews. And, you know, we're talking about Erin Hills in Wisconsin. Sand Valley's about 2 hours north, closer on up to the middle of the state, just west of Green Bay a little bit. It's a Mike Kaiser invention. The Coeur Crenshaw course is open now. There's an excellent piece in Global Golf Post about it that John Steinbreder wrote in this last week's Global Golf Post. Plus, our good friend Craig Brass wrote an informative piece in the Metro Golfer about Sand Valley and his golf trip up to Wisconsin. Wisconsin is trying to do a golf trail similar to what Alabama has. And, you know, when we were up there a month ago, we played Erin Hills, and then we also played Brown Deer County Park, which is also a part of that golf trail. But Craig played several golf courses up there, and he does a nice job talking about Sand Valley in his article, too. That's in the Met Golfer magazine. Carlos, that's all I have for June the 6th, 2017. But I do want to, before we close up here, this was D-Day, I believe, June 6th. There wasn't much that I saw about it today, so just before we close, I want to just give a shout-out that, you know, all those guys that stormed that beach to make that happen in World War II, that was the beginning of the end for the Third Reich and our buddy Adolf Hitler, and so this is a very memorable day in history, and we should note it.
I extend those congratulations for you. Everybody remembers all that sacrifice, not only them, but all the members of the Armed Forces that did for us. And with that, Back Niners, that's up another week of the Back Niners Report. Remember, next week we're going to have a preview of the U.S. Open, and Kieran Clark will be with us. Thank you for listening. It's always our pleasure to bring you the latest on the world of golf. Special thanks to our VIG, very important guest of the week, Mike May, our friend who's going to have a dream trip to the Atlantic Link. Don't forget to join us again next Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time here on Blog Talk Radio. Or if you just missed it, hey, check it out on iTunes or tune in. Also, remember, we are Roku TV. You can watch us now. And if you haven't done so, follow the show on Twitter. Our ID is at Back9Report with the number 9 in the middle. Hey, my name is Carlos Torres. Along with Fred Alvader, we wish you to be happy, be blessed, and enjoy the great game of golf. Happy golfing, everybody.
Good night, everybody.
Try my barbecue bacon cheeseburger combo with sweet or spicy barbecue sauce topped with bacon and onion rings, plus fries and a drink for just $4.99.
Jack, I love you.
Okay. Only a Jack in the Box. Small fries and small drink. Limit time only. Price and participation may vary.
Panera now delivers, so you can order good, clean food right to your office or door or porch or backyard or front yard. Or apartment, or dorm, or castle, or shop, or worksite, or wherever. For lunch, dinner, and everywhere in between. Click the banner to order or visit PaneraBread.com. Participating locations only. Panera. Food as it should be.